So we are going to spend the next 3 weeks immersing ourselves in a work of Jewish philosophy that's been described by one commentator as a bombshell, which is somewhat dramatic, and we're not going to discuss it this week, but has been described by someone far more sensible as significantly unique in the context of Orthodox Jewish philosophy. I prefer the slightly more technical term absolutely bonkers. But either way, the book is The Emergence of Ethical Man, by Rav Soloveitchik. I don't want this to be a book club, which is precisely why I've not encouraged people to go out and buy the book. People can feel free, to go out and read the book. It's a really good book, but I want to focus more on the broad ideas found within the book rather than going page by page through the book and just discuss it. I want to focus more on the broad idea, the broad point Rav Soloveitchik is making. But it's actually important just to discuss the book itself for a second, because Rav Soloveitchik never published it in his lifetime. It was discovered as a series of 10 notebooks he had written. And this version of it, which wasn't published until 2005, the editors basically decided what is a footnote, what is the main text, those sorts of things. But by and large, they left it as is. It already raises the question, why didn't Rav Soloveitchik publish this? And there's two kind of ways of thinking about it. One is he, at a certain point, it's also unfinished, and it's not a finished work. So he also gave up on it at some point. We have good reason to assume he wrote it sometime during the 50s and the 60s, but he didn't decide to publish it. So the question is, did he realize halfway through, nah, this is not going anywhere? Or alternatively, is it simply Rav Soloveitchik was a very hesitant publisher? Many of the things published in his own lifetime were written decades before he chose to publish them. Some people have that kind of personality where they're so concerned that they've not written a quality enough product that they kind of push it off for a long time. Rav Soloveitchik was known for being that kind of person. So one of the other broad questions we will have to answer, not tonight, is really how incongruous is this with his thought? If this truly is a bombshell, and it's a complete departure from everything else Rav Soloveitchik ever said, then maybe it's a philosophical curiosity that at one point he thought these ideas enough to write them down. If, on the other hand, it's not really so far beyond anything else he said, it's just he's finally discussing this topic, and therefore he wrote what he wrote, then it's, and that's basically how most people tend to view this, then there's less reason to think that he was just afraid to publish it for whatever reason. And one thing I will say that comes very clearly from the book, and I've mentioned this before, I mentioned it definitely before we read the Rav Soloveitchik piece on the must-reads, something that we sometimes fail to appreciate about Rav Soloveitchik was that he was a legit philosopher. In the sense that there are, and some of you will have heard me say this before, there are plenty of rabbis who dabble in philosophy, but few of them are actual philosophers, who philosophize and do all those things you'd expect kind of a continental philosopher to do, or a philosopher, he's a German philosopher, and that comes through time and time again in this work, in so many of his other works. And again, we're going to see that a bit today, and we're going to discuss that in other weeks, how clearly and obviously, he gives name to a who's who. I forgot to write the list down before I came out, but the who's who of German philosophers and major philosophers of the Western world are name-checked in this book alongside major halachic figures. That's something we take for granted with Rav Soloveitchik. The book itself is incomplete. It's only like 200 pages. Conveniently for my three-week format, he splits it into three sections, which works nicely, though we're not actually ending each class at the hard end of each section because I wanted to do it a bit more for flow. But just before I actually hand out the source sheets and we start reading the very beginning, The Emergence of Ethical Man is a work of philosophical anthropology. Philosophical anthropology, if you Google it, has been kind of a thing for a long time. Like, as far back as philosophers, they've always been doing philosophical anthropology, but the person who made it into what it is was a German philosopher called Max Scheler. For those of you who took part in the must-reads, that name will already ring alarm bells because we talked about him at length when it comes to Rav Soloveitchik's view on repentance, and we will have much cause to return to Max Scheller at the end of today, and also in the coming weeks. But in a nutshell, philosophical anthropology seeks to answer what makes us human. What is it that makes us us? What is it that defines us as humans, in contrast to all other beings? And Rav Soloveitchik, in The Emergence of Ethical Man, proposes an answer. But that answer, at least I think for most of us walking in with preconceived ideas of what Judaism believes and what Judaism doesn't believe, Rav Soloveitchik's answer is absolutely bonkers. And with that, I'm going to hand out the source sheet. There should be more than enough for everyone. If you could just take one and pass around, please. And you'll see most of this, we're not kind of looking at the book, but I literally just scanned, you know, the first paragraph of the book and then another very important paragraph to actually look inside. So you can just see this is what the book itself actually looks like. But just give everyone a moment to hand out the sheets. Okay, let's take a look at, this is the opening paragraph of The Emergence of Ethical Man. And Rav Soloveitchik says the following. Should we inquire of a modern historian of philosophy or of any educated person well acquainted with the history of ideas, what he understands by the word man? Just brief point to make here. Rav Soloveitchik, being a basically German philosopher writing in the 50s or 60s, uses the term man the whole time to refer to humanity. Just nowadays, you don't do that. You say humanity rather than man, but get used to it because man with capital M is referring to humanity. There we go. And he would immediately advise us about a basic controversy concerning the destiny or essence of this being. By sheer force of associative thinking, he would at once refer to three disparate anthropological philosophical viewpoints. Three different views on what makes human human, what makes man man. The biblical, referred to by many as the Judeo-Christian view. The classical Greek and the modern empirico-scientific. Pressed further, he would probably say that the discrepancy between the concepts of man dating back to antiquity, the biblical and the classical Greek, is by far not as wide as the gap separating those two from the empirico-scientific one. As a matter of fact, he would say, we may speak of some degree of affinity, of commensurability, between the biblical and classical anthropologies. Both are united in opposition to the scientific approach to man. They set man apart from other forms of organic life. Rav Soloveitchik sets the stall out right away. Three basic views of looking at what makes us human. Of those, it's really two broad groups. The first, either the view of the Torah or the view of the Greeks, is that man is special. We are created, B'Tselem Elohim, within the image of God. We are somehow unique. We are somehow special. There is something that makes us human that is quintessentially different from all other organisms on this world. In contrast, the view of science is that really we're just upgraded animals. And he wrote this in the 50s and 60s, and again, footnotes, which technically in his actual words weren't footnotes themselves, he's citing a lot of relatively, you know, recent scholarship for his own time of the scientific process. But if in his day, you know, the idea of evolution and those sorts of things were strong, you know, recent discoveries in neuroscience only bolster the fact that, quite frankly, from a scientific point of view, there is not that much fundamentally different between us and all other animals. You know, the gap between a scientific thing being proven among mice or rats and humans is vast. But the whole idea that if we see how rats react to something, that can teach us something about maybe how humans react to something, captures the idea that we aren't fundamentally different from animals. And Rav Soloveitchik says this presents the religious person with a problem. What's fascinating, by the way, is he says he has no concern whatsoever about the question of what he calls the so-called evolution versus creation. That doesn't bother him. What bothers him is that from the Torah's point of view, humans are special. From the scientific perspective, we are not. And that has theological repercussions. Because if we aren't much better than animals, if we're merely upgraded animals, then that's a kind of meh. Then that kind of destroys a lot of the seeming significance of what we are supposed to be. If, on the other hand, we truly are created, B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God, if God created us to be unique beings to walk this world, then we obviously have, you know, a grander purpose. And Rav Soloveitchik does, there's ellipses here, but he basically sets out some of these issues already. And then he returns to the fact that, you know, the religious viewpoint is to view humans as special. And then take a look at this, the next paragraph on this same sheet. But Rav Soloveitchik then says the following. It is certain that the fathers of the church and also the Jewish medieval scholars believed that the Bible preached this doctrine, that we are special. Medieval and even modern Jewish moralists have almost canonized this viewpoint and attributed to it apodictic validity. Yet the consensus of many, however great and distinguished, does not prove the truth or falseness of a particular belief. I have always felt that due to some erroneous conception, we have actually misunderstood the Judaic anthropology and read into the biblical texts ideas which stem from an alien source. This feeling becomes more pronounced when we try to read the Bible, not as an isolated literary text, but as a manifestation of a grand tradition rooted in the very essence of our God consciousness that transcends the bounds of the standardized and fixed text and fans out into every aspect of our existential experience. The sooner biblical texts are placed in their proper setting, namely the oral tradition with its almost endless religious awareness, the clearer and more certain I am. The Judaism does not accent unreservedly the theory of man's isolationism and separatism within the natural of or order of things. In other words,
is it supposed to be accept, or is that the word, the intended word is accent
or accept?
I mean, it says accent. I don't know if accent is usually used in that way. As in, I didn't type this, I just scanned this from the book. So yeah, it could be a typo in the original book, or it could be, as Rav Soloveitchik sometimes does, he knows English better than people who are, he knows English because he learned it, and therefore he knows the purpose of words that no one else actually knows. Accept would make sense though. Either way, what Rav Soloveitchik sets out to do is something that's absolutely bonkers. Argue that Judaism always believed that on a certain level being key, we are nothing more than upgraded animals. And what he uses to use the kind of philosophical language is what he wants to do is distinguish between ontic man and ethical man. Ontic man, ontic is a fancy philosophical word. It basically means what we actually are as beings. As in what makes us physically us. And as he's going to argue, and as we're just going to focus on tonight, what we are physically is nothing more than at best upgraded animals. Where we come to the fore, what Rav Soloveitchik also says, to use kind of the Jewish, the theological language, the difference between Adam and Tselem Elohim, the difference between physical person and a person with a soul, is ethical man, which we'll already start exploring next week. But what Rav Soloveitchik starts to argue, and we're going to look at today, is fundamentally, there is nothing that makes us special as human beings. That ultimately, we are no different than all the other organisms that walk, or for that matter, remain rooted in their place on this earth. Yes, Mark, you have a...
Could you talk a little about apodictic validity? She refers to...
It's like, it is the thing. Everyone agrees to it, it's unquestionable. That's the, we assign it, it's we don't even question for a second its correctness.
So it's an assumption?
But more than that, it's like, it is true. Yeah, it is true.
Clearly established
and beyond dispute. There you go. So Rav Soloveitchik roots his argument here in the story of creation. And it begins by looking at source number one and noting how the Torah describes the creation of various things. So what we have here is just a selection of verses from both the first and second chapter of Sefer Bereshit, which say the following. Vayomer Elokim tachei ha'aretz desha. Let the earth sprout vegetation. The creations of plants, the earth sprouts them. If you skip along to the beginning of verse 20. Vayomer Elokim yishritzu hamayim. Let the waters bring forth sheretz nefesh chaya. And va'ov yo'ofeif al ha'aretz. Swarming things, flying things, let the waters bring forth all of those. Verse 24, Vayomer Elokim totzei ha'aretz nefesh chaya lemina. Let the earth bring forth every kind of living creature. And describes various different types of animals that are created at this point. And then finally in chapter 2, Vayitza Adonai Elohim et ha'adam afa min ha'adama. And God formed man from the dust of the earth. Vayipach ba'afav nishbat chayim, blew into his nostrils the breath of life. Vayihi ha'adam lenefesh chaya, and man became a living thing. How is man created in the second perek of Sefer Bereshit? In the exact same way, everything else is created in the first. Plants, fish, animals, and humans are all created from the dust of the ground, or in the case of aquatic animals, water, but fine. Everything is created from the ground. This, by the way, Rav Soloveitchik already points out, is why Judaism thinks burial is so important, because you are returning humans to their, you know, natural place of origin. Something else interesting to note, which we aren't going to talk about today, is that, and it's something we're going to look at a lot more, at least implicitly, Rav Soloveitchik abandons the first chapter of Bereshit, description of how man is created here, in favor of the second. There are a lot of ways where Rav Soloveitchik seems to like the second chapter more, and he devotes a lot more time to it. We'll discuss that a lot more next week. Again, there is a certain amount of rhetorical value running through this work, but what Rav Soloveitchik is trying to argue here is that we are created from the very same ground, the animals and the plants are. And he points out, if you look at the broader verses surrounding this, you start to also see a lot of linguistic similarities between the creations of humans and the creations of everything else. And this leads Rav Soloveitchik to already make the following point in source number two. And at this point, any strange words might be just a typo. Man in the story of creation does not occupy a unique ontic position. There's nothing special about us fundamentally. He is rather a drop of the cosmos that fits into the schemata of naturalness and concreteness. The viewpoint is very much akin to modern science. Again, how much of this is trying to be a polemic? As in, Rav Soloveitchik was bothered by the challenges science presents, and Rav Soloveitchik is like, nope, it does not bother anyone, because we can actually, if we read it carefully, we'll see it's not bothered by it. And then Christianity split the story of creation in two and analyzed the story of man without taking cognizance of that of animal and plant. That is why it arrived at half-truths and misinterpreted the biblical anthropology. What is definitely true is that the casual person's, be it Jew or non-Jew's, knowledge of the Bible tends to often portray a Christian understanding, and more so than maybe people would like to admit. Though, again, we'll see next week, Rav Soloveitchik absolutely and openly takes Christian understandings of the story and rereads them. Again, next week we'll see that Rav Soloveitchik completely subscribes to a sense of original sin. And he openly says, I'm stealing it from the Christians, but I'm going to re-understand it here. So again, that'll be next week. But the point here is, as he makes very simply, we aren't special. There is nothing physically about us different to us and all other organisms. And he starts by contrasting us with, or comparing us to, plants. And that's kind of interesting, because you would think, Rav Soloveitchik points out there's kinds of few different classifications. Inanimate objects he's not going to bother with, because they are just meh. But before he compares us to animals, he spends almost a lot more time, and it's more interesting to compare us to plants, because animals, I think we all implicitly get, because we are all immersed in a world of science enough for us not to be too struck by that comparison. But first, Rav Soloveitchik wants to say, no, actually, plants are organisms, and we are organisms, and there's not actually that much difference between us. And he begins by pointing out, take a look at source number 3, concerning his entire physiological-biological functional system. Breathing, assimilation of organic matter, circulation of blood, glandular secretion, and so on, man does not differ from the plant. In other words, how do plants get by? Well, we assume everything happens kind of automatically. Plants don't will themselves to do any of the stuff they do. They just do it naturally. And Rav Soloveitchik argues, and again, he's quoting here like books on botany, which is also interesting. But his point here is basically most of the fundamental things we do, we also don't do consciously. We are not reminding ourselves to breathe. We are not reminding our hearts to beat, or most of our bodily functions are taking place with complete unawareness of ourselves. And Rav Soloveitchik's point is, at a fundamental level, all organisms, be it the plant or the human being, however complex the human being may be, fundamentally runs on the same automation, runs on the same unconscious script that the plant does. And that already for Rav Soloveitchik is a key comparison between us and other organisms, and a key point to argue that, look, we fundamentally aren't that different. Mark, you have a question while I take a sip.
So is he talking on a cellular level? And also, does he take into account discoveries about DNA at the time?
So he does not. Again, I'm not sure when these very scientific discoveries were taking place versus when he's writing it. He quotes... Actually, I have the book right here. He quotes, let's see if I can find it very quickly. It's one of the early footnotes, which is how I know. The curse is whenever you try to find something in a few seconds, you can never actually find it. That is the, he cites it. This was what I was thinking of, but, the reason I was thinking this is the book on plants is because the guy's first name is Gardner. And so I thought, oh, this is the book on plants. But it's Personality, a Biosocial Approach to Origins and Structure. And he also quotes the mind and its place in nature. So he's citing those things, but it's not necessarily explicit botany right here. But his point basically is he's not going into DNA. Again, that would bolster the argument even more that we are made of the same matter. But he's also, again, he's looking for philosophical reasons. So he's trying to point out more than just the literal physical similarities, and kind of there's almost like another level slightly higher than that of, you know, we do these things subconsciously. What Rav Soloveitchik also points to is a fascinating biblical command. It comes towards the end of the Torah in Sefer Devarim. Take a look at source number 4. Ki tatzor el ir yamim rabim lehilachem aleha letafsa. You're besieging a city in order to capture it. With laws of war here. Lo tashchit et etza lindoach alav garzen. You must not destroy its trees, wielding the axe against them. Ki mimenu tochal, because you eat from them. Ve'oto lo tichrot, you must not cut them down. Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh. Are trees of the field human? Lavo mipanecha b'matzor, to run away from you? Rak eitz asher teida. Ki lo eitz ma'achal hu. Only non-fruit trees. Oto tashchit v'charata, can you cut down? Uvanita matzor al ha'er asher hi osemcha milchama ad ridita. You can only cut them down for constructing siege works. To try and, against a city that's waging war against you. There is this entire principle and prohibition of cutting down fruit trees. And while there's a variety of reasons given, Rav Soloveitchik basically argues here, and he has a great quote. He has a great line. We have the impression as if the Torah placed the murder of trees above the slaughter of humans. As in, you're besieging people. You're gonna conquer it. You're clearly going to be killing a lot of people in that city, but don't touch the trees. They don't deserve it. They can't run away from you. And what Rav Soloveitchik, again, there is, it's a rhetorical argument, more than necessarily a substantive one, but the Torah cares about trees. Surprisingly so, says Rav Soloveitchik. The Torah seems to recognize through the lens here of Rav Soloveitchik the fact that we don't fundamentally differ so significantly that we can just destroy whatever we want, that we can just hack down the trees because we want to, because they will somehow speed up the war. No, we have to treat the tree carefully. Practically speaking, is this really teaching you that you can't destroy the food supply of a besieged city? Probably. But again, rhetorically, philosophically, Rav Soloveitchik is pointing to this and saying, the Torah somehow recognizes some sacred element here to the tree. And the other thing he points, and we're going to look at, going to talk about a couple of things in another second, but the other thing he points out is how often we are referred to as trees and plants in prophetic literature. One of the favored prophetic analogies is that we are trees. We are plants. Countless times we are trees in the field, we are plants in the this. Again, for Rav Soloveitchik, this signals a not too striking difference between us and plants.
But he makes a distinction between trees that will provide food and those that won't. So the trees that provide food, in essence, you know, provide life, you know, help, you know, establish life and continue life, whereas the others.
Yeah. And that's
something that promotes life in any form. You know, I mean, animals eat, the fruit of the trees also. But I mean, there's a distinction there between life.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying I think a lot of this is rhetorical.
Yeah.
Because there are certain aspects of this where it's like, this isn't necessarily the purest argument you'd make, but he's trying to marshal sources to indicate that the Torah's view, Judaism's view here, is not so far from, you know, the scientific viewpoint. How well he argues this is a separate question. And again, it's absolutely bonkers. Because you get the impression, and he's kind of quite open about this, he's set out to do this. And he wants to prove there's no challenge presented by science. Rav Soloveitchik, in a sense, is trying to, and we're going to talk more about motivations and et cetera, not today. But Rav Soloveitchik really wants to show that the scientific viewpoint does not present a challenge to the religious one. And if he has to get there by creatively reading certain sources, that's what he'll do. Again, the source one, the selections from creation, do point to something, even if he's splicing the two creation stories. Nonetheless, some of these others are more tenuous, but one final argument he makes, which I think does have a lot more oomph to it, is he points out that if what made us human was the existence of a moral sense, a consciousness, some sort of, you know, ethical gesture, as opposed to our onticness, our ontic selves, then Rav Soloveitchik points out there are two endpoints at life that you can argue halacha still considers you a human. And that is the fetus and the goses. The goses is essentially the comatose person, and the person who is, for all intents and purposes, no, they're on the brink of death, but their bodily functions are still working. And the truth is, both the fetus and the goses are halachically very, very complicated, practically speaking. But what Rav Soloveitchik says here is, if they are considered humans, it is because they are heart beating, they have lungs, you know, whatever lungs do, breathing. And yeah, I was trying to think of a better word than that, but that's probably a good one to describe what lungs do. The fact that the bodily functions are working before or after any sort of mental capacity is there. What you are basically, you know, the term is, for someone comatose, this may not be the correct medical term, but someone in a vegetative state. They are basically acting like another kind of organism, and yet, says Rav Soloveitchik, they are a human. Therefore, humans simply are living, breathing, you know, blood circulating beings. Fundamentally, that's what makes us human. That's not all that what makes us human, because there's another 2 weeks to this. But fundamentally, when science says we are upgraded animals, Rav Soloveitchik says, Judaism says the same thing. There's gonna still be a gap next 2 weeks. But fundamentally, when science says we are upgraded animals, upgraded organisms, Judaism says, Rav Soloveitchik says the same thing. Yes, Mark?
Aside from Hebrew, which language is he writing in? Yiddish?
This he's writing in English.
In English.
This was written in English. The next thing Rav Soloveitchik turns to is the kind of the more obvious comparison between us and animals. And Rav Soloveitchik makes what is probably not in any sense, I mean, it's not at all a controversial idea, but again, he musters it to in aid of this broader idea that we are nothing more than upgraded animals. If you take a look at source number 5, and it's again from Bereishit Perek Aleph, after man has been created, after humans have been created, Vayoma Elohim, hinei natati lachem et kol esev zorea zera asher al pnei chol haaretz, I have given you every seed-bearing plant that's upon the earth, Ve'et kol ha'et asher bo free ha'et zorei ha'zera, every seed-bearing fruit, lachem yihiyah lo'ochla, they shall be yours for food. U'lechol chayat ha'aretz, u'lechol of ha'shemayim, u'lechol romes al ha'aretz asher bo nefesh chaya, et kol yerek esev lo'ochla v'yihi chen. And to every other animal, vegetables are food. What's missing from the human diet at this point in creation? Meat. And again, it is a not controversial point at all to note that the Torah idealizes vegetarianism. From a what things should have been, humans were originally created to not eat meat, says the Torah. And indeed, we just read last week, Parashat Noach, God gives special dispensation for man to eat meat, though there is, and Rav Soloveitchik points out, immense reluctance on this part. It's like, well, if you're going to kill, you might as well kill animals for food. But as Rav Soloveitchik points out, I think this is one of maybe the less known things about Judaism. But at least in biblical times, or in ideal biblical times, meat eating was still so much more restricted. Take a look at source number 6. So this is from Sefer Vayikra. Ish ish mi beit Yisrael. Asher yishchat shor or chesev or ez b'machane. If someone slaughters an animal, in the camp, or asher yishchat michutz l'machane, or outside the camp, v'el petach ohel moed lo hevi, or does not bring it to the entrance of the ohel moed, the tent of meeting, lahakriv korban l'adonai, to offer as a sacrifice, lifnei mishkan adonai. Dam yechoshev la'ish ahu dam shafach. Blood guilt shall be upon him, v'nichrat ha'ishahu mikarevimah, and he shall be cut off among the people. In biblical times, the law was, in the times of the Torah, you could only eat meat if you were going to do it as part of sacrificial worship. Chazal point out that the Torah itself and relaxes these rules, and once the Jewish people arrive in the land of Israel for practical considerations, because every time you want to have a deli sandwich, you can't be walking 15,000 miles to the Beit HaMikdash to offer a korban when it's in the midbar, the wilderness, and the Mishkan's only, you know, a 20-minute walk away. You can do that. But there is an immense reluctance on the Torah to allow meat eating. Even originally when it's allowing meat eating, it has to be done in the service of God. And the actual eating of meat is a byproduct of your service of God. And again, as Rav Soloveitchik points out, the term often used to describe meat eating in the Torah is ta'ava, is lust. There is a moral judgment behind the eating of meat, that the eating of meat is somehow an excess of us as humans, this fact that we desire to eat meat. And when you look at the language of Source 6, you realize, and Rav Soloveitchik really, really emphasizes this point, that animals are living beings. To kill a living being, the Torah might permit, and in some cases, very extreme circumstances, very specific circumstances, but the point is you are still killing a living being. In the service of God, it's one thing, because God has commanded you to do so, but fundamentally, from Rav Soloveitchik's perspective, we should not think that the gap between us and other animals on this world is so vast that we can kill them at will. To do so is a reluctant dispensation of God at the end of Parashat Noach that we read last week. To do so is ta'ava, is our following of lust. To do so is not something the Torah has any tremendously positive reflection on. This is not to say we should all be vegetarian, but it is to say that even if we shouldn't be vegetarian, that's not to say the Torah kind of, you know, permits us to, you know, just willfully slaughter every single, you know, animal we see and eat it to our heart's desire. Mark.
So what does that mean in light of the destruction of the temple or temples?
So I believe it's been now a year, less than a year, but since I learned Chulin, but something at the back of my mind is scratching to say that there is the hypothesis that in the world without the Beit HaMikdash, meat eating is prohibited, which is not accepted, practically speaking, obviously. And again, even in a world with the Beit HaMikdash, the point is once you were living in the land of Israel, you're too far from the Beit HaMikdash to be able to just continually be offering sacrifices. So meat eating was then broadly permitted. But the very fact that there is a law on the books that seeks to restrict it is in and of itself telling. The fact that in a world of the Midbar, where the Jews are living in the wilderness in Torah times, the fact that meat eating was still restricted. And again, think of the episodes in the Torah where they do eat meat. They aren't good stories. It's like the people were complaining and wanted meat, and God is like very, very angry at the people and sends swarms and is practically choking them with meat. He does not look kindly upon, you know, this idea. And Rav Soloveitchik really, really builds on this idea to again stress that part of that, what we might call ethical sensitivity to animals, is the recognition that fundamentally we aren't so different.
Just quick question, side question. So do we know anything about what Soloveitchik did in his private life? Ever knows what he ate and didn't eat?
He definitely ate meat.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He was not a vegetarian. Rav Kook famously, though I say famously with hesitance because I'm not sure what the actual story is, but people say Rav Kook was a vegetarian, except on Shabbos and Yom Tov. There is a modern day halakhic question over vegetarianism as an ideal or not. On the side of pro meat eating, tends to be the world of Chabad. Who really takes seriously the idea that you eat meat and drink wine on Shabbos and Yom Tov. And then on the other side, there's Rav Kook, who's very ethically sensitive to the plight of animals, and this was very against the kind of mass killing of animals for the consumption of meat. You know, there are definitely times where you see... So for instance, one of the famous examples is some people have the tradition on Erev Yom Kippur to do kaparot with a chicken to wave around their head. So there's several reasons not to do it. But one of the reasons often offered is that what people think is happening with those chickens is they will be slaughtered and given to the poor. But the likelihood of them being slaughtered in a kosher manner, because it's very hard to do at the speed that it's taking place, is very low, and therefore you're just basically gratuitously murdering animals that are never going to be consumed by anyone. And so there are those who point out halakhic problems with this. There is at least one relatively prominent rabbi in YU who does not think veal is kosher, because he thinks there's no way to ethically slaughter it. I personally love veal, so, you know. But nonetheless, he is adamant that there is no world in which you could actually have kosher veal, because just the very idea that you're slaughtering a young, you know, whatever is crazy. So you do definitely see this this sensitivity or this care or this feeling emerge in a lot of halachic sources. I've quoted before Rav Lichtenstein, who lamented glatt kosher hedonism, where, you know, this, which tends to be kind of the way the world works in the 21st century, where we do kind of just eat what we want and it's all kosher and we don't care. But you definitely see, there are people in Maimo who might be able to know how much of a meat eater Rav Soloveitchik was, and I can ask them tomorrow and tell you next week. He definitely ate meat, but I would doubt he was that guy at the wedding with his plate stacked 15 things, like me, who's walking around like a kid in a candy store, only the candy is meat, you know.
The writer Isaac Sandor, we used to frequent, there were a lot of dairy restaurants in New York years ago, like one famous one on the Upper West Side, Steinberg's. And Isaac Sandor lived up there too, and he said, quote, to the animals, every day is for boyka.
Yeah, there are people who,
I mean, just,
you know,
comparison.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I have seen a shechita. One of the things you have to do with smicha is you watch one live to see how it actually works. They say you walk out of there a vegetarian. You don't. I'm not a vegetarian. But it is just, I mean, I would be one of those people who, having seen it, I can now be like, everyone who's going to eat meat has to first see an animal. Because I can be pretentious because I was forced to do it in order to qualify as a rabbi. I will say it is disturbing to watch, but it did not make me think I will never eat meat again. But it made me think this is kind of, you know, because animals do display very human emotions. They get very afraid when the shochet walks into the room. It's kind of terrifying. It's kind of very disturbing to watch. But Rav Soloveitchik, you know, really hits at this idea that we are allowed to eat meat, but we should be aware of, again, that the difference between the cow on your plate, I had meat tonight, the cow on my plate tonight, fundamentally was not so distinct from I that I am its, you know, ruler. And I can just, you know, kill it at will because I so desire it, which is basically our relationship to meat. But yes, Herb, you had a...
What's the philosophical argument then about eating plants and vegetables? If vegetables are nefesh chaya, animals are nefesh chaya, we're nefesh chaya, there's a qualitative generic to all this.
God gave us.
You don't eat the tree.
God gave us.
You can only eat the fruit of the vegetables.
Yeah.
That's like
so,
saying you can only eat the seeds of vegetables. Not the
crunch
of
your carrot.
You have the seeds.
Right.
So look, again, if you look at source 5. I've given you all this stuff. You shall eat it. By the way, there is a, for people who are aware of the halachic controversy about eating vegetables and fruit because there may be bugs inside, there is a book, unfortunately, actually, the person who wrote it was murdered by terrorists. But the book is called Lachem Yihyeh La'Ochla, because he's riffing off the fact here that explicitly we are commanded to eat vegetables and fruits. That is supposed to be our food. So, you know, he writes a book basically arguing why we shouldn't be as concerned for you know, not eating these things for fear of bugs. Because, you know, lachem yeliyachah, they were given to us to eat. But yeah, so the simple answer, especially from a Rav Soloveitchik perspective, would be there is a divine command which tells us these are our food. And I just think it's important to look at source number 7 here, because I think it really hits, you know, this that all organic existence is on one continuum is a postulate of Judaism. But the Torah does not apply uniform standards to all organic life. human life is evaluated at the apex of the biopyramid, what was termed Selem, and plant at its base. But the difference consists only in degree, not in kind. Man may be the most developed form of life on the continuum of plant, animal, man, but the ontic essence remains identical. So he's not saying Bessie the cow and the shrubbery on the table, which is probably fake, and all of us are equal. He's not saying, as some contemporary ethicists have argued, that, you know, the murder of an animal is akin to the murder of a human. He's acknowledging there is a pyramid. That there are, and again, the whole rest of the book, you know, ethical man has yet to emerge. So there is going to be something that makes us distinct from everything else. But his point is, biologically, we are the same. Our difference consists only in degree, not in kind. So yeah, we are upgraded animals. We are, you know, degrees higher than animals, but fundamentally, there isn't that much difference between us. You know, you go to the zoo and you see the animals doing things and you're like, you know, depending on the animal and depending on the humans, they are doing things awfully similar to one another. You know, if you've been blessed with children, you know, right now Shai is 14 months and I refer to him in the puppy stage because quite frankly, there is not that much difference right now. We have friends who have a dog. There's not that much difference between our 14-month-old and a puppy. He walks around the room following us, dogs wag their tail, he smiles, but he's not, you know, Yair, who's four, is now human. Like, clearly and obviously does things, but like, you know, when Yair was a baby and our friends had just got a dog, we were having the exact same conversations. Like, about, you know, bathroom, eating, weird things that maybe we need to take them to the doctor about, or the vet. You know, there is a point at which a human becomes a human, but it's not day one. Because for at least a significant period of time, there isn't that much of a difference. Like, fundamentally, it will happen, and it's why it takes us so many years to mature. And, you know, I mean, honestly, I teach 13-year-olds, so I'm not sure when they will become human. But the point is if there is degrees, not kind, that there is a certain level of just, you know, and again, with what we know of neuroscience and the development of the brain over time, you know, we are far more like animals. And again, we'll touch on this a bit next week. We are far more like animals than maybe we even want to admit. Rav Soloveitchik, really, it's the end of this section, but we're going to talk about it next week. Rav Soloveitchik points out, you know, and we're going to talk about this a bit more. All of us, all organisms have drives. And those drives lead them to act. And fundamentally, it's the same drive in all of us. The drive to eat is the same drive to eat that motivates the animal. Again, we'll talk about that the next week. But one final thing before we just wrap up for today. One thing Rav Soloveitchik points out, which is really cool, is that the relationship between humanity and the land is supposed to be very important. After all, what happens to Adam and Chava when they are punished? We're not reading the quote yet. What happens to Adam and Chava when they are punished? They are exiled from the land. What happens to Jewish people when they are punished? They are exiled from the land. What is the Torah's most frequently recurring threat? Things won't grow. And again, why? Because it's an agricultural people, at least, you know, in the Torah's time. But what Rav Soloveitchik says there is a clear relationship between us and the land. We have a duty and a responsibility because fundamentally, we're just on one continuum and we have a relationship with one another. And he ends, you know, what is the chapter? Source number 8 here. Man should create new life. He should plant trees and engage in such creative work. The intimate close contact with the environment was recommended and approved by Judaism. The Jew whom God called upon was a worker, a farmer, a shepherd. Men who lived in harmony and at peace with nature and saw God not in transcendent heavens, but descending from infinity into finitude. They had spoken to him as to their fellow men in a friendly, neighborly fashion. To cultivate the ground means to worship. Avodah. In it is expressed man's loyalty to himself and to his destiny. Remember, we are placed in the earth in the story of Bereshit, Li'avdah Olam Shamah, to serve the land. And so for Rav Soloveitchik, it's not just that these, that we are similar and we are all on the same continuum, but that already starts to exert a certain relationship between us, that we have a relationship to everything, to the animal and the plant, because fundamentally we are all part of the same broad thing. We all share that ontic similarity with one another, and therefore that leads to certain levels of responsibility and certain levels of expectations also. But what, and again, there's two more weeks, so there's a lot more to say about what actually makes us human. But what Rav Soloveitchik begins with is the assumption that I think most people would say, which is, what does science believe about humans? We evolved. We are nothing more than upgraded animals. What does Judaism believe about humans? We are special. We were created uniquely, B'Tselem Elokim, and we are unique as beings. And Rav Soloveitchik argues that is not correct. Judaism and science both agree to the same thing. And again, this is probably a polemic, but Judaism and science both agree to the same thing. We are fundamentally upgraded animals, at least ontically. As we are physically speaking, we are nothing more than animals. However, as we'll start to see next week, there is a major difference between us and all other organisms in this world, and that's when we'll start to see the emergence of ethical man. But what I do want to end with is just kind of to already raise this. I mentioned at the beginning the name Max Scheler should raise alarm bells, because he wielded a tremendous influence on Rav Soloveitchik. So you might want to like separate the page from the staples to do this better. But this was pointed out, I did not notice this, Rabbi, almost Dr. Alex Ozar, who's finishing his PhD in Yale right now. And when I reached out to a professor of mine from YU, like, who's the best person who writes stuff on emergence of ethical man? He's like, Alex Ozar. And I've actually met him. He's like not much older than me, which is depressing because he really knows his stuff. So he has an article in Harvard Theological Review about Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy here in, The Emergence of Ethical Man, and he points out Max Scheler's Man's Place in Nature, which was written in 1928. There is no arguing that Rav Soloveitchik read Scheler and not vice versa. So with kind of one eye on the very beginning of Rav Soloveitchik, which we already read, take a look at the beginning of Man's Place in Nature. If we ask an educated person in the Western world what he means by the word man, three irreconcilable ways of thinking are apt to come into conflict in his mind. The first is the Jewish Christian tradition of Adam and Eve, including creation, paradise, and fall. The second is the Greek tradition in which, for the first time, man's self-consciousness raised him to a unique place on the grounds that he is endowed with reason. The third idea is that of modern science and genetic psychology, which also has a tradition of its own. According to this view, man is a very recent product of evolution on our planet, a creature distinguished from its antecedents in the animal world only by the degree of complexity of energies and capacities already present on a subhuman level. These three ideas are not compatible with one another. Thus, we have a scientific, a philosophical, and a theological anthropology in complete separation from one another. So this is the cliffhanger. But Rav Soloveitchik was clearly cribbing from Max Scheler when he wrote this. Max Scheler's Man's Place in Nature is before him as he writes The Emergence of Ethical Man. He would have read it in the original German. And the fact that Max Scheler exerts a crazy influence on Rav Soloveitchik doesn't come as a surprise given what we spoke about of Teshuvah. But this is also something else we will have to address, because what's very clear is that Rav Soloveitchik was setting out to write a Jewish version of a book already in existence and already very important, at least for German philosophers. And so not only do we have to read all of the absolutely bonkers things we've read so far and kind of take stock of what they actually mean and what they will imply, but we also have to see this as a very conscious attempt to answer a question that had already been posed by other people, by other philosophical anthropologists, and Rav Soloveitchik is trying to give the Jewish answer. But it's very clear, because he literally uses the same, you know, the same exact structure of Max Scheler here. The three views, they're in conflict with one another. he uses that at the beginning of the emergence of ethical man. And that in and of itself is striking, and that's something else we are going to have to discuss over the next couple of weeks as we try to uncover the influence and motivation behind Rav Soloveitchik writing this book that he never finished nor published, but nonetheless, if not a bombshell, was at least a unique contribution to Orthodox Jewish thought.